This is the What Now Podcast.
One of the definitions of an addiction is that it doesn't just want more, it wants different in order to hit the brain the same way, to excite the brain, to get the dopamine going. And so we're not just talking about pornography.
This is the What Now Podcast, where we discuss the culture and beliefs in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in an honest and faithful way, in an effort to encourage, uplift, and inspire. I am Mary Alice Hatch, your host. Join me as I speak with Rill Croshaw, who shares the reality of her journey being married to someone caught in the cycle of pornography for over 32 years. She shares how she found out about the addiction, how she navigated the relapses, and the breaking point that finally brought her husband to seek the recovery he desperately needed. Rill shares how she got the help she needed to recover from the betrayal, fear, and bitterness she felt, and what led her to create a program to facilitate healing for thousands of families whose lives have been affected by the devastating effects of pornography. Today, I'm here with Rill Croshaw. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm so happy to have you on the podcast today. I'd like to just start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself so listeners can get to know you better.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here with you. I was born and raised in Montana. I count myself a Montana girl, even though it's been 50 years since I lived there permanently. I am the oldest of nine children. We have seven children, all married, and expecting number 29th grandchild on Sunday.
Wow.
We are really excited about this little boy to come to our family. Very much a surprise. I went to Montana State University on a piano scholarship and then got married. I went to Utah State in music and eventually ended up getting my degree in marriage and family from BYU at the ripe old age of 58.
I love that.
I went back to get my degree and it wasn't in music, much to my dismay. But the direction that I had gotten in my early 50s, I was to go to BYU in marriage and family. And little did I know what that would mean for my future. I had no idea. As soon as I graduated, I wrote a book called What Can I Do About Me? Recovering from the Effects of My Husband's Pornography and Sexual Addiction. That was, like I said, almost 11 years ago. And that needs an update because it's been 10 years. And so I'm planning on doing an update on that book. I don't feel that I'm an author. It was never on my bucket list to write a book, but I knew that it was something that was really critical for me to share with others the recovery journey because it is real and possible. My husband and I started SA Lifeline Foundation 15 years ago. And with the hope, and all we had was the idea that we had finally found some resources and tools and guidance to long-term recovery. At that point, it was only 3 years into good recovery for my husband. And we just wanted to offer hope that it was possible. So that's been 15 years ago. We do a lot of work for SA Lifeline Foundation, and we'll probably talk a little more about that and what that means in our lives and in the lives of thousands of other people that we've worked with through the foundation and through SAL 12 Step. I think that's enough about me.
Yeah, that's terrific. That's terrific. You know, we often hear about the journey of someone who's caught in the cycle of pornography, but we don't often hear the perspective of the spouse and how they deal with the struggles associated with that challenge. So today we're going to talk about your journey being married to someone who was caught in that cycle of pornography and how you dealt with that betrayal trauma, because it is a traumatic thing. it's almost like you're being cheated on, but not with an actual person, a virtual experience, or sometimes it is, it does lead to that. But I just want to know, how did you figure out that your husband was struggling with pornography?
I didn't. And often a person who uses pornography can do it very much in hiding. So many women will not know. With today's technology, that these behaviors can be done totally in hiding and in secret. So I actually never knew of his background. He actually discovered pornography. This was many, many years ago, because he's now 71, when he was 6 years old. And that was, of course, printed material. He was six. He gave the magazine to his mother. Nothing was said about it. And then he continued to be interested and curious, and probably developed an addiction by the time he was 14. And masturbation became part of that. Then in high school, acting out with some girls. But he never talked about that really, except he did go to some church leaders when he was older and talk about it. And the hope was that he, being a good kid, a good guy, that he would just get over it. Again, that was many, many years ago. I did not know anything about his behavior until we were married about 14 years. I guess it was 13 years. And he one day just said, "I've got to talk to you." And he was afraid, because pornography is not, we're not just talking about pornography. We're talking about an addiction to lust. And so it shows up, pornography is actually what we would call, I would call, the entry drug into this addiction. Many guys who actually act out in different ways with addiction or toxicity to lust, they don't even do pornography anymore. They might have done that in their youth when they were teenagers, young adults, but they've gone on to other behaviors. And so one of the definitions of an addiction is that it doesn't just want more, it wants different in order to hit the brain the same way, to excite the brain, to get the dopamine going. And so we're not just talking about pornography. And it's interesting to me how many women that will call me and they say, "Well, he says he doesn't do pornography." Well, we're not talking about just pornography. We're talking about affairs, strip clubs, prostitutes, child porn, sometimes voyeurism, all sorts of behavior that are lust-based, sexual lust-based. And so going back to the question is, I didn't know anything about his behavior until that day when he said he was concerned that he had an STD because he'd been with a prostitute. And so I didn't know about his, 30 years of history with pornography, masturbation, acting out, strip clubs, and prostitutes. And that came out, again, about 14 years into our marriage. At that point, I had no idea what we were talking about, and neither did he. That was so many years ago. We have now just celebrated 6 months ago our 50th wedding anniversary, which there are many, many miracles in between. And so for 32 years, he struggled with this, but he could be sober, not acting out with anything for 3 years at a time. Now, sober is not the same as recovery. And so sober is quite often white knuckle sober. And the alcoholics know that term, the drug addicts know that term, white knuckle sober. But that is not recovery. But that's what he had the first time, 14 years into our marriage. He was white knuckle sober for 3 years. And then he knows exactly when it hit him again. He traveled a lot. for his business. He was very successful as a businessman, and he knows where he was in a hotel, and he chose to go on a pornographic movie. And as he says, it doesn't just easily, slowly go down into acting out with in strip clubs and prostitutes. For him, it really is, once he went there, he was back in it full blown. Mm-hmm. And he was able to hide that for another 7 years. Because he could travel, he was acting out when he traveled. And so I didn't know any of that, even during that 10-year period of time. I never felt like everything was okay. But when I would ask him, he would say, "I'm fine." And really, sometimes with some resentment that I was not trusting him.
Mm-hmm.
And that attitude of, "How come you can't trust me?"
Mm-hmm.
Usually showed up when he was actually acting out. So 10 years later, from that first disclosure, he disclosed again. And that time, I went into fix it, control, manage this mode.
Mm-hmm. Naturally, yeah.
Because, I mean, what are we going to do? At that point, we had 7 kids. And it's like, I have to help him fix this. I found a book called Willpower is Not Enough. I found the therapist who had written that book. I called all over trying to find this person. I found he went to 4 12-step meetings. He didn't like them. And he had, we didn't understand. I knew about boundaries as far as raising 7 children. I knew what boundaries were. You know, if you don't come home on time, you're going to have this consequence.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really hard to understand how to have appropriate boundaries with a husband who I really couldn't trust.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but right there where I went into, I've got to help. I don't think I called it fix and control at all. I just wanted to help. And it didn't work. Because
it feels so scary, right? You've got 7 kids. You're at home raising this family. He's traveling. He's gone all the time. You really can't monitor anything that he's doing because he's gone all the time. So how did that leave you feeling? Did you feel kind of panicked? I mean, how did you manage that?
Well, you know, I was thinking that finally I was finding some answers. Willpower is not enough. This must be more than just a bad habit. There must be more to it than what I thought. And so in my effort to try and fix and help, I think I kind of had this attitude of I'm doing something. And yes, there's fear that actually is the reason that I went into that in the first place, to try and control what was happening in our family. And of course, after the second time, he was very remorseful and he had some church discipline again. And I just thought, well, maybe we've got it this time. And I've worked with thousands of women in the last 15 years. My story is not unique. And I thought, you know, 30 years ago, my story was really unique. Nobody talks about this. A lot of people feel shame around it. And why can't he stop? Why doesn't he stop? Why am I not good enough for him? Women have these feelings of lack of self-worth. And I could talk for an hour about what that does. So the second time he was like, yeah, I'm going to do this. But I read the book. I went with him to therapy. He didn't like 12-step. And I thought that was, you know, we had a year of therapy. It wasn't actually qualified therapy. It was not adequate for sexual addiction. And there was no help for betrayal trauma. But back in those days, betrayal trauma was not even a term.
Mm-hmm.
It was, if we can, you know, if he stops doing this, then everybody will be fine, right?
Mm-hmm.
No, that's not the case. Because betrayal trauma is a real, its symptoms are PTSD symptoms. And so you don't tell someone that was, in the 9/11 bombings that they just get over it.
Right.
Because PTSD, there are scientific behaviors and an understanding of what PTSD does to a person that needs to be understood when it comes to betrayal trauma.
So how do you build trust after these relapses, right? And now, and then you're dealing with serious things like sexually transmitted diseases, things that can really affect your physical health. So how did you build trust after these relapses, and how did you have the courage to stay?
Trust is built one day at a time. Forgiveness is a gift between me and God. And that was really important for me to understand, because I had been taught that you just forgive and forgive and forgive. And we do. But trust is earned, and it's built one day at a time. So going back to my story, then another 7 years later, in 2005, my husband was arrested for picking up a prostitute. However, he didn't have to be traveling anymore. He could go to the larger city next to where we lived and be doing his work and pick up a prostitute. He didn't have to be traveling. And so we have to understand that those who are involved or sucked into this type of an addiction, they will find ways to act out because that's where their brain is. Mm-hmm. So how did I find trust? The third time, literally on the front lawn of our home on a Sunday morning, he told me after 2 weeks, because he had held this for 2 weeks, he had gone to an attorney and said, I want, you know, what had happened. And the guy said, did you really say you were guilty? No. And so he paid him $1,400, $1,500 and got him off. And so he thought at that point, I will never have to tell. But he could not live with himself, thankfully. Mm-hmm. And we call that, he calls it, a miracle, angels in blue suits, policemen, who were actually sent to him to say, enough is enough.
Mm-hmm. That's a tipping point, yeah.
It was his rock bottom. Mm-hmm. But he went for 2 weeks without saying anything to anybody else, including me. But he couldn't stand himself. And that's where a person has to get, where they recognize that they're willing to let go of everything else for their own soul. Because yeah. He knew that if he continued on this path, he was literally going to die. It's probably sooner than he expected.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of different reasons. So he finally got honest on a Sunday morning, and I turned my hands to heaven up. I turned the palms up and said, take him. I can't do this anymore. And that was my first day of real surrender. I let go of all of my feelings of, I've got to fix this. I've got to change this. I'm afraid of what's going to happen if this doesn't change. I'm afraid of divorce. Nope. That day I just said, God's going to take care of me. I still had twin boys at home, teenagers, 5 married kids, and I let him go. And my thought was, this is over. 32 years of marriage. We've worked really hard. I've worked really hard. And I've tried to take care of this. And he hasn't done his part. Mm-hmm. And maybe at that point, I thought, maybe he can't do his part. Maybe he's incapable of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I surrendered to God that day, that morning. And that day, he told his church leader, he told every single one of our adult children, he sat down with them and their spouses and told them his entire story separately, not all together.
Wow, that takes a lot of courage.
It was, and our kids were devastated.
I bet.
Devastated. Our daughters sobbed and sobbed and sobbed. our sons, our married sons were so, I mean, they were red-faced, angry, yelling at their dad.
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, that was cathartic. It was, you're going to have to be so humble and honest to take whatever comes your way. And I didn't glory in that at all, but I did feel that this was important for him to do. And because it was important, I believed that it was the right thing to do. I was able to support it and just be quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And watch. And from that day on, I thought, we separated for a time, which was really good for both of us. It was a day, one day at a time. I'm going to see with God at my center what he's willing to do. And it was really important for me to understand that he was going to have to want it as much as he wanted to breathe. And that's really important, because it wasn't because he was going to want it to keep the marriage together. He really needed to want it for himself.
Mm-hmm.
Because nobody knew if the marriage would continue. He found a really qualified therapist. I didn't. He found the books. He started going to 12-step immediately and never missed. He would come home from those meetings so humble and so grateful for the guys who were ahead of him and his sponsor who was helping him, who was like 6 or 7 years sober with the same behaviors. And he would come home so grateful. I started seeing a different man. And I started understanding what the therapist had said to me the very first meeting after he had heard the whole story from my husband. And I just sat there and listened. He said, could you stay with him if he's in recovery? That's why I say recovery and sobriety are not the same. You have to be sober in order to have recovery, but you cannot say you're in recovery just if you're sober.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew that I had seen periods of sobriety, but I don't think I'd ever seen any recovery. And it was going to take all that he could think of to do. So he never missed a 12-step meeting. He was reading the books. He was going to therapy, asked if I would go. So the reason that I started being able to trust is I started seeing a difference in behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can't, you know, the manipulative, resentful, lying, lustful, angry, the victim attitude, the withdrawn. My husband was not an angry addict. He was a withdrawn addict.
Mm-hmm.
But he could be resentful too. So when I see those behaviors, even now, 18 years later, because he's 18 years sober as of last Friday. It was his 18-year birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And we celebrate every year on that day. But how would I know? Because he was so good. He was such a manipulator and liar. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that someone can change? I believed that it is. I've always believed that. But I thought, for 32 years, I'm not seeing this. So I've got to see something different. Instead of this self-absorbed person that the addict becomes, had to be more connected with God. Whatever religion or spiritual nature a person has, doesn't matter to me. Connected mm-hmm. with God.
Mm-hmm.
So he started doing that. He had consequences with our church, and that was hard, and it was good. I knew it was the right thing, and so did he. Our children knew that it was the right thing. They said, especially our boys, said, Dad, we believe you can change, and we're going to watch.
Which is encouraging, right? I mean, he hit a low. You've been able to release control, right? Your palms are up. I'm releasing control.
Yeah.
This is beyond me. he had to hit rock bottom, realizing he was going to lose everything.
Yeah.
And then he made the internal change, the brain switch. I'm doing something here.
Right.
Right. I mean, you can pester, you can control, you can do all these things. The kids can pressure, shame, whatever to get the change, but he had to want the change.
Right.
Right. And I love that your kids were supporting him in that change. I mean, they could have turned away, cut him out of their life, been so bitter, but they're like, we're looking for the change. We want to see the change,
yeah,
which might have helped him really stay committed to it. Like, my kids are really believing in me too. I'm going to do this.
Yes. And he knew that he was disconnected as a father. And he spent the last 18 years working on connecting with our children in so many ways. And he's a very connected grandfather. He's a different man. And I've appreciated that, but that was not going to be the only answer for me. When I could see change in him, I also needed to recognize, and the motto of SA Lifeline Foundation is recovering individuals, healing families. We started to recognize that we could not recover a marriage, recover our, even individually, unless I worked my recovery. And so I started in 12-step probably 4 years, maybe 3 years after he did. I didn't think I needed any of that help. We both went to therapy. I went for 3 years. He went for 4 years. I thought, you know, we're good. We have discovered in the 15 years and working with thousands of people, this is not an a la carte program. Recovery is not an a la carte journey. It is a combination of things that will bless a person's life long term. And so those things are qualified therapy. The things that we talk about are qualified therapy, boundaries and bottom lines for safety, quality education, and spiritual connection supported by SAL 12-step. But you cannot do any of those without a willing heart. And that was required for me when I finally said, I'm willing to work recovery from the PTSD and trauma I've experienced. And that has been critical for recovery of our marriage. He could recover. That sounds like a past tense. Recovery is ongoing. Even though he's sober for 18 years, recovery is a daily process, which is life. It's healthy living. But if I did not work recovery for my trauma, I would live in fear, resentment, anxiety, bitterness, all of these negative things I don't want to live with.
Right. Well, what resources did you use to help you with that kind of PTSD and recovery?
Well, therapy helped, but it was not the answer. It was not the answer. And so 9 years ago, we started SAL 12-step for betrayal trauma groups for women and addiction recovery for men. There are those who have been betrayed who are men, and there are women who deal with the addiction. And we've tried to start those groups and haven't been very successful at them. So right now we have 52 meetings a week that reach around the world on Zoom and some in person. The resources that I found were some therapy and some education for certain about what PTSD or betrayal trauma really is. I needed that education to know what I was dealing with. If we do not properly diagnose what we're dealing with, we do not have the proper intervention and of anything. And so the intervention for me was some education, the same with my husband, some education, qualified therapy, boundaries and bottom lines for sure, and SAL 12-step work. This morning, I was in a meeting with 10 other women, and it, even after 18 years, it centers in me, focuses me, helps me to deal with anything that takes me out of serenity in my life. And that can be neighbors, children, my husband. Yes. Yesterday I surrendered him because I was like, really? And then, like all marriages do, you know, have issues.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've all kind of got those issues too. I mean, aside from the cycle of pornography, you have real life marital issues too, and conflict and resolution and all that goes with that.
Yes.
Yeah. So how can a marriage, how did the betrayal trauma, I like that you wanted to understand what that was, so you knew how to take care of it.
Yes.
You know, I mean, how did you even find someone who understood betrayal trauma and had a resource for you? Like, how do people go to find that? Is your foundation a resource that helps people find what they need to handle all of this?
Yes. SA Lifeline and SAL 12-step is unique in the fact that we put as much weight and emphasis on addiction recovery as we do on betrayal trauma recovery. Because we know from experience and working with thousands of people that families do not heal unless both people work healing. And so finding someone who is a qualified therapist can be difficult. Betrayal trauma is more well known, there's more education about it than there ever has been. But there are still many therapists who do not understand and will actually do more harm to women in relationships than they do good. And so it's really important. APSATS, that group is specifically for betrayal trauma. Some CSATs are very well educated in that. I wouldn't say, you know, not every therapist is the same. But SA Lifeline is unique in that fact that we see both as critical recovery critical recovery for long-term recovery. Our therapist about, 13 years ago, we did a little checkup because I had a trauma response that was just laid me out. And it didn't have anything to do with my husband sexually acting out, which was so interesting. But I wanted to drive as far away and get so far away and never see him ever, ever again from an experience I had. And so we went to our therapist for a checkup the next day, and he said something that was really important for both of us to understand. Betrayal trauma is cellular. It is in your body. It will not leave you. It's PTSD. But what you need to know is how to deal with it on a daily basis. And that's what I work on. That's what I teach other women. It's not going to ever totally leave you. You might have a trigger just totally out of the blue at the grocery store. And how do we deal with that trigger so it doesn't just absolutely paralyze us? And that's what women need to be aware of. Therapists need to be aware of. The helping community. She's not crazy. She has a trauma response. And here are the tools. The tools are, you get some education about this. Again, these are what we call the recovery puzzle pieces. And then I work 12-step. And I learn to surrender the things I cannot change. Most people are aware of the serenity prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Courage to change the things I can. And the wisdom to know the difference. Guess what? We cannot control the adults in our family and in our relationships. I tried for years. I couldn't fix it. I couldn't change him. It is not possible. But what I can do is surrender him and his stuff, which is not the white flag that I give up. It is literally me giving it the best I can to God. And I do a process of knees, foam, box. I pray it. I write it down on a little scrap of paper, and I have a surrender box. And I pray, and I make a phone call to my sponsor. She doesn't even have to answer, because this is a process of me giving something I cannot change to God, the only power that can do anything. And it's the God of your understanding, my understanding. That can be different. And so that is a process that has really, really helped my recovery. I have a sponsor. I actually have two. And they work their program, and so we help each other. And I'm accountable to them.
But and what's the program that you're in?
SAL 12-step.
SAL 12-step. And how do people find that program?
SAL12step.org.
Okay.
And that there are, again, it's gender-specific, God-centered, spiritually-centered, not religious. There is a sobriety definition of and that we hold very clear and firm. And a lot, there's a lot to it, but it's pretty simple. And so there are online meetings, and those meetings are to be safe meetings. We don't do men bashing. We do not gossip. We talk about our own recovery work. And that can be hard at times. And it is. The path of the progress tends to be painful. And in this situation, it tends to be at times, not always. But those women who have walked this path help other women walk the path, just like the men do. I'm so grateful for my husband's sponsor and the fact that he's able to sponsor a number of men who are walking the same path. They're striving. They want to change because they want to feel good about themselves. And the same thing for women. I want to feel my self-worth again. Too many of us have lost our self-worth and we've lost our courage. One of my favorite quotes from a Christian writer that I put in the back of my book is, redeemed women of God have tender, merciful hearts. Yes. Backbones of steel and hands that are prepared for the fight. Now that is the kind of woman I want to be. I want to continue to have that tender, merciful heart. I don't want to have a hard heart. I don't want to be angry and resentful. Although I will say, anger is appropriate because I think I finally got to the point when I could say, no more, no more. I'm not doing this anymore. And I think that there's a little bit of anger in there that says, okay, I'm not going to be the doormat. I am going to stand up. I'm going to have a backbone of steel and hands prepared for the fight, which is not with my husband.
Yeah.
The fight is with the adversary.
I think it's actually pretty cathartic to do that. you know, sometimes getting angry kind of releases a lot of that angst and stress and worry and fear and makes you feel like you are empowered in some way to make change.
Yes. I that's what I have found for most of us as women. If we do not have a feeling of no more, then we don't make a change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like a breaking point.
It's like our rock bottom. This is not going to happen anymore. And so I have boundaries. I have boundaries around certain behaviors, like lying or even resentment and victim attitude, withdrawn and all that. I have boundaries around that. And for me, for us, we know that if I'm not feeling safe with certain attitudes and behaviors, we sleep separate. And I talk about it and I say, I'm not feeling okay with that. And so therefore, I'm sleeping separate tonight because I need my space.
Well, that also makes you feel like empowered, that you have some control over your relationship.
Well, I have control over myself.
Yourself, yeah. Yeah.
Because I can't control the a relationship is two. He's got to choose and so do I. And so, but I have back to the serenity prayer, courage to change the things I can. Oh, I can change what is happening in my life. Mm-hmm. The boundary.
Mm-hmm. And well, I wanted to talk about when you went public with this about 12 years ago, about what you've both been facing for so many years. How did you get past the worry about what other people would think? It is such a secretive cycle with pornography. I mean, a lot of people are really worried about that being a stigma piece in their life. You know, I mean, it can be really scary to go really public, and you went public. How do you have the courage to do that?
Oh, it was, that's not easy. And we don't encourage couples early on to do that because you never know. this addiction is cunning, powerful, and baffling. And so it takes a lot of effort and time, consistent effort and time, not perfection, consistent effort and time. And so our therapist had said this will take 3 to 5 years of active work for recovery, and then it will be, from there on, it will be healthy living. And that has been true. So it was 3 years when we started the foundation, but our story was not public. So it became public 12 years ago when we were asked by our local, it was Deseret Media in Salt Lake, to if we would be willing to be part of a video, a documentary that was going to be run on a certain Sunday, and would we be front page newspaper? I mean, it was going to be a full-blown blitz. And I was like, I don't know. And then I recognized I had, you know, my husband had to be the one to say, am I okay with this? And me too. I mean, it was both of us. And then we asked all of our children, who of course knew the story, and they had seen years of active recovery work. So one of our sons, who was serving a mission, wrote back and said, I'm not afraid for people to see our whole family. There are many, many people whose front yards look really nice, but the backyards have stuff in them. And I appreciated his attitude. Like, and every one of our kids gave us that okay. And our church leader actually encouraged us to do it. Our therapist encouraged us to do it. But even then, it was, I remember after everything came, you know, it was in the newspaper, radio, TV. One day I was just so sad. And I just said, this is my life. And I went out to the mailbox, and there were 8 letters and cards from people who had known us over the years, who had seen all of it, and who had sent letters expressing their love and appreciation. And I knew that was God working in my life. I just said, thank you, because this is hard.
Yeah.
But I knew that even when I wrote, what can I do about me? It wasn't for me. And I've never made a dollar on it in 10 years. It was for somebody else, for some other woman who was suffering like I had suffered, mm-hmm. who was on her face on the bathroom floor, bawling her eyes out and saying, I don't know what to do next. How do I do this? I'm afraid. I don't know what to do. I knew it was for somebody else. And that's the way we have felt all along. This mm-hmm. is for someone else. Is it possible to recover and have long-term recovery? Not only recover, but to find a sense of joy in a relationship that has been so severely damaged. It is. I can say that from my own experience.
Mm-hmm.
Our marriage is better than it ever has been at 50 years. In all ways. In every way. Physically, emotionally, spiritually. But people don't get that because mm-hmm. it's a hard journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. I mean, and for some people, it is appropriate to leave. And for some people, yes. they yes. feel compelled to stay. And in your situation, now the Lord is using you to help thousands of people with this same journey that you went through. And your perspective and your experience is very healing and encouraging for this group of people who need you. So, I mean, it's like a mission.
Yes. And you know, I appreciate something you just said. For some people, it is appropriate to leave. And I work with women who have, even after years of effort, their own recovery, their own work. And sometimes it comes in a year. Sometimes it comes in 5. I have never said to any woman, you should leave or you should stay. It's none of my business. It is her between her and the God of her understanding. And sometimes it takes time. Sometimes it's, but usually it takes more time than not mm-hmm. for her to understand what God wants her to do so that she feels confident and courageous and serene. I'm working with a woman right now who's in that process. literally in the process of determining after like 5 years whether she should leave, whether the divorce is the answer. All I can say to her is, God will let you know. Mm-hmm. And I know it because I work with women. And they not only, the other key part of that is that just because I'm divorced does not mean I don't need to keep working my recovery. Because if PTSD, betrayal trauma, is cellular, I'm going to carry it around with me. I need to work my recovery.
That's an important point.
That is really important because mm-hmm. as mothers, as women who have influence, we need to be the best we can be. And without recovery work, then I am this woman that is just like in that place of, I don't know, I'm confused, I'm paralyzed by fear. No, I need to be that woman of backbone of steel and tender, merciful heart. And recovery work gives that courage, that purpose. And so many women who don't recover and don't work recovery will end up in another very similar relationship. And I've seen that many, many times.
That's so interesting. Why is that? Why would someone even be drawn to something remotely close to what they were running from?
Without recovery, we tend to take the same attitudes into all relationships. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important. And I have in my recovery book, I have written, I just wrote myself a note. Imagine myself at 80, a bitter, resentful, fearful woman. That is not pretty. And so that motivates me. I'm 70 now. That's not that far away. I want to be a woman of confidence and courage, whatever my relationship is, because it's me and God first. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to look to my husband to fill my God hunger. He's not my central figure, and I shouldn't be my husband's central figure. We connected with God is the answer. But how do we do that when we've had betrayal or when we've had addiction in our lives? That's what we work on.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about the SA Lifeline Foundation and how do people find that? I want to offer resources to people who are listening to this, who are wanting that help. Where can they find it?
SALifeline.org is our website for the foundation. Website is educational. It offers the books that we publish. What Can I Do About Me is on there in audio and print. Other books, there's the SAL book, which is really important for people to read to understand what we're talking about as far as betrayal trauma and addiction and what that recovery looks like. So we publish 5 different books, plus we have some other books that we suggest. Dopamine Nation is one that we really like by Dr. Anna Lemke. She was a speaker at our conference last year. We have an annual conference every year, and we happen to have it coming up September 9th at Salt Lake Community College. It can be part of it by online or in person, and then you can see we have amazing speakers coming from different parts of the nation. And so that is SA Lifeline Foundation. SAL 12 Step is under the umbrella of the foundation, but it is 12 Step, just like, well, I can't say just like, but we follow the 12 Step pattern of AA. And so we only have a few words in our 12 Steps that are different, and one of them is sexual addiction, and one of them is we changed, it says in all affairs, we changed that to in all aspects of our lives, because affairs can really trigger some people. And so we follow the 12-step tradition of AA that was put together, inspired in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And again, I mentioned that they're gender-specific, God-centered, prayers from the heart, not religious, spiritually, based. So those are the two things, SA Lifeline Foundation and SAL12step.org. And if you wanted to really see what we're all about, you'd register for the conference on September 9th. And that would be a good idea of who we are and what we talk about.
And do you register for that through your SALifelineFoundation.org?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Well, I want to just thank you so much for being vulnerable and sharing your story. And we know this is much more common than we want to believe.
Yes.
And that there is hope and healing for spouses out there who are living with this cycle of pornography with their spouses. I mean, women have this too.
Yes.
So, I mean, this is for men and women to help them on this journey. And you're an important part of that. And I am just in awe at your bravery and courage and determination, and to use your experience to bless the lives of other women out there. So thank you.
Thank you. It's we feel like it's a calling. It's not easy, and some days are discouraging, but most days are like, we'll just do the best we can. Our messages of hope and healing and recovery and a feeling of peace that all of us need in our lives, with all the chaos and confusion. That's my goal every day.
Mm-hmm.
Have peace.
There's hope and healing out there, and you are an example of that. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the What Now podcast. If you would like to learn more about how you can get help for your loved ones who struggle with the cycle of pornography, you can go to www.salifeline.org. That's www.salifeline.org for more information. Please share this episode with family, friends, and anyone you think it might help. Just click on that share button wherever you listen to podcasts. If you're on Instagram, follow us at @podcastwhatnow. For inspirational messages and highlights from our past and present episodes. We never say goodbye, we say what now. This has been a What Now podcast production.